If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
You need parts? O'Reilly Auto Parts has parts. Need them fast? We've got fast. No matter what you need, we have thousands of professional parts people doing their part to make sure you have it. Product availability. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? I'm your host, Michael the Pod Pina, and I'm joined on the other line by my good friend, Sports Illustrated staff writer Rohan Nadkarni. Quick apologies for posting our first episode this week one day later than normal. I'm not here to cast blame on anyone, but that said, Rohan had some technical difficulties yesterday, and we are excited to get back in the swing of things right now. Rohan, the sun is shining. Birds are chirping, and Al Horford is finally getting the respect he deserves. These are truly beautiful times. How are you doing?
So first of all, let me give a more formal apology to both Mike, our producer, JC, the Open Floor Globe. I just had an incredibly stressful day yesterday, finally flying back to Los Angeles after being on the road for the first 4 games of the Phoenix-Dallas series. You know, the traffic, you get back from LAX, you're immediately back in the traffic. You arrive home to find out your internet is out. you can't do the podcast that you look forward to doing every week. So thank you to everyone, to their patience. I was excited about the Al Horford game because loyal listeners of the pod will know that I came out and gave a full-on Al Horford monologue, I think, during that Brooklyn series about how great he's been. And he's saving Jason Tatum, a.k.a. like everyone's trying to tell me he's the top 3 player in the world after beating up on like the Nets, you know, collection of 6-3 players.
All I hear about is how
good Jason Tatum is. Then last night, he's just terrible for about 45 minutes. Al Horford carries the team. And, you know, Tatum gets to pad his numbers there a bit at the end. But, yeah, I'm happy for Al Horford, certainly.
I do wonder what reality you live in, what you ingest before we record these episodes. But Tatum obviously was, he struggled in the first half, I will give you that. And we're going to get into all of it in a second, but I just had to say that, you know, 30-15 or 30-12-5 or whatever he had is a pretty good
He was bad for
game.
About 3.5 quarters.
That's just not true.
I believe he had 18 points headed into the fourth, and I believe he hit 8 in the last 5 minutes.
Rohan, on today's show, we will be dipping into all four second round series and opening up the mailbag once again. But first, a quick reminder to please keep those emails coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com.
There's an email. I'm not sure if we're definitely going to get to it today, but I actually have a lot of beef with, so it'll be interesting to see if we get there. But keep the emails coming because I like it. I like kind of the diversity of discussion going on in the emails, so keep them coming.
Okay, so I don't like deviating too far from the outline here, but now I'm just, my brain is frazzled. I'm super curious what email you're talking
about.
We'll
have to see.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm going to be in suspense for the next 45 minutes. So Rohan, today I gave you a homework assignment.
That I famously do every time.
Yes, you do. You're very good. You're a stickler. You are clearly a teacher's pet to this day. I asked you to ask one big question about every series that's still going on. It could be as general or specific as you'd like, be it about a coaching decision, a player, a matchup, whatever. We briefly touched on Boston-Milwaukee at the top. Why don't we just start with that series?
Let's do it.
Last night, the Celtics beat the Bucks, tied the series up to a piece, going back to Boston on Wednesday night. What is your did you do the homework assignment?
Yeah, of course, of course.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, you leave me in the lurch here. Like,
come on,
I mean, my
dude.
Goodness.
No, of course, man.
Okay. Do you want to kick things off? Cause I have a question, of course, as well.
Yes.
But why don't you kick things off and we can get the conversation started?
I do, and I don't think my question's going to be a surprise to you because we had a robust discussion in our group chat yesterday after game four. But, I mean, that was such a – first of all, what a good game that was, man. That was so much fun. Just high-level playoff basketball. Two really good defenses. In all seriousness about Tatum, and I said this during the game on Twitter, like – that was one of those games where, like, I don't think either team in this series is going to play particularly efficient offense. I think asking for high efficiency from the stars is unrealistic. It's just, can you find ways to assert yourself? Can you find those little holes, pockets in the defense, etc.? I mean, I think both teams are trying to do that when they can. My question, honestly, is what were the Bucks thinking on offense? Because you and I had this discussion after the game. Like, I just got the sense that Milwaukee was in control of that game and should have won it. And I understand the Celtics' defense is very good and that Milwaukee's offense is compromised without Chris Middleton. At the same time, like, some of their decision-making still baffles me. Like, there's multiple instances in the first half where Giannis got Peyton Pritchard switch on him, passed out of it immediately for like semi-contested threes, didn't work those possessions at all. I thought Drew Holiday was like over pivoting in the paint. I found like multiple times that like he got to his spot but then pivoted one extra time and got out of his spot into a worse shot. There's just little things like that that I see that Milwaukee does, and I understand this has never been, you know, a finely tuned offensive half-court machine. I understand that they're going up against a defense that is very good. I mean, both teams are forcing the other into bad shots, but I just thought Milwaukee's decision-making on offense left a lot to be desired, and that game was there for the taking because of how much Boston's, you know, offense was struggling outside of Horford.
So what's your question?
What is Milwaukee thinking on offense? I led with it. What are the Bucks thinking on offense is my question.
So, I mean, one of the reasons why I picked the Celtics in five and was so confident in it is because their offense isn't very good. And honestly, it's really interesting to me how their offense hasn't really evolved or improved. And I know Middleton isn't out, so that's like a caveat here where that factored into it in a humongous degree because you
He's
need
there,
big wings
yeah.
to go against a team that forces more isolation offense than any in the league. So that obvious caveat aside, the Milwaukee Bucks offense, you know, hasn't been super great for like three straight years. And they won the title. And that always, when you win a title, obviously it shifts how you're perceived to in a great way. And
Giannis's like big nights can kind of mask how much they 100%. Struggle offensively. Yeah.
100%. And Giannis had a stretch in the third quarter, I think it was, where he kind of figured out Al Horford a little bit. And I don't know if Al Horford was tired, if Al Horford was really worried about picking up more cheap fouls because Rob Williams was not available and Grant Williams was in foul trouble. And Daniel Tice is just like not an option in this series at all. But yeah, like their offense just isn't very good, and they can't, if they want to create space for Giannis, they usually have to go small, although Brook Lopez played pretty well. Bobby Portis has basically been rendered.
He's kind of out of this series, yeah.
And so it's like those Peyton Pritchard possessions, so it was like a couple of those. I'd have to go back and watch. Those ones specifically aren't on my mind. I would imagine what Giannis is thinking on those plays is like Al Horford or who, there's someone is in the paint, like standing in the paint when he has the ball, and the kick out to an open 3-point shooter is the smart play in his eyes and wanting to get off the ball as quick as possible.
I get it. I mean, he kicked it out to Portis on one play. He kicked it out to Connaughton on the next play. I mean, Connaughton's been a great catch and shoot guy for them. I hear you, Mike, and I don't want to take credit away from what Boston did, because it's equally impressive to me that they won that game considering the foul trouble guys were in all night. I mean, Jalen was in foul trouble. Grant was in foul trouble. Horford, I think, had to adjust the way he played because of it. Tatum picked up a couple early fouls, never really was able to get into a rhythm. So I'm with you. Like, I think we were having this discussion last season until kind of that towards the end of that Brooklyn series. Like, you know, there's a reason why during their title run, people were like saying, what is Bud doing? It took them forever to really start, I think, utilizing like the Chris Giannis pick and roll last season. I think most coaches would have probably started going to it earlier. I still just felt like their offensive decision making, that can be improved. Like, their process, I think, can still be improved a little bit if they're willing to work their offense a little bit. And then you have Jrue Holiday. I mean, I understand he was taking a lot of tough shots, but that is a – I think it was James Herbert who tweeted a fun fact. It was kind of a joke, but everyone was getting on Dylan Brooks last night. I mean, Jrue Holiday shot even worse than Dylan Brooks did last night. I mean, it was one of the just all-time baffling shooting performances.
Jrue Holiday was 5 for 22. He was -23. He scored 16 points.
Nikias Duncan tweeted Jrue Holiday was a -23 and he played only 10 seconds more than Giannis, who was in the positive. Like, that's crazy.
That is very, I don't even know how that's mathematically possible.
Yeah.
Obviously they were staggered, but anyway, the Jrue Holiday, look, I wrote before the series started, or I think maybe I wrote it after game one. I honestly can't remember. Jrue Holiday was one of the better isolation scorers and playmakers in the league this season. And that was going to have to be, he was going to have to win one-on-one matchups. Mm-hmm. I felt for Milwaukee to generate quality offense in the half court, I assumed that Boston wouldn't turn the ball over as much as they have, unforced sloppy turnovers, which they continue to do, and they did last night. And one of the reasons why they were down in the third quarter was those turnovers. But Jrue Holiday is averaging 0.657 points per isolation possession in this series. That is very, very, very bad.
Yeah.
And early on in the series, the Celtics did not want to switch Horford onto him, partly because they didn't want to switch Horford off of Giannis, partly because Jrue has had a lot of success against Horford on an island. Jrue had his way early on in this series against Tatum. And that those shots and those looks, be it against Grant Williams, be it against Derek White, who's someone who he tried to challenge a few times last night and just came up empty. Jrue Holiday.
I mean, he had moments like this. I mean, you remember that game 7 against Brooklyn? He was really bad until the last couple minutes of the fourth quarter.
Yes, 100%.
He has these stretches, so it's definitely within him. It wasn't completely shocking.
He's an amazing player. He is stretched beyond, like with Chris Middleton out, he's stretched beyond what he is paid to do and what his role should be in this context on this team. That's not a criticism of him. That's just like, that's the facts. So that's what happens when you're down an all-star.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing all-star. Same thing with Harden, same thing with Aaron Gordon, for example. Yeah.
So it's, what is Milwaukee? Like, I don't know what Milwaukee can do offensively to improve their situation. Like, two of their five worst half-court offense games were in this series, in the entire season. Which is just like, that's just remarkable. Mm-hmm. It speaks to Boston's defense, which is smothering, which is so focused on Giannis and so precise in how they're switching their help defense. You know, they have adjusted really well to when to double, when not to double. The fact that they played as well as they did last night, I know Rob Williams hasn't had the greatest series and is clearly physically compromised, but to do what they did last night, when small, and this leads me to my question, which is, can the Celtics have sustained success with the small ball lineup that carried them to victory in game four? Last night we saw Tatum, Derek White, Marcus Smart, Al Horford, and Jaylen Brown appear in a game for the first time since the first game of the postseason against Brooklyn. And that lineup was one of the most attractive ones on the day of the trade deadline. Mm-hmm. I thought that this would be a key five-man unit for them in the playoffs. They went to it last night. It basically saved their season. They generated 1.67 points per possession on offense. The Bucks to 78.9 defensive rating. Go ahead, Rod.
It was remarkable to watch. I mean, down the stretch of the game, we're putting Horford in the corner, and Tatum's running a pick and roll. And we're going to make either Giannis or Brooke or whoever was in the game at that time decide if they're going to help off Tatum because Wes Matthews is pressed all the way up on him and give Horford the corner shot. And they killed him with it. And it was like Mavs-esque. It was, you know, what are you going to do when we kind of spread you out? And it was, you're right. It saved that seat. It was incredible to watch.
You're right. They put Horford in the strong side corner. They forced switches where Tatum, they would have Marcus Smart or Jaylen Brown set a screen, whoever basically George Hill was guarding. And honestly, like, George Hill's playing a lot for me if I was a
Bucks
fan. I was
surprised. And it's not that I think he's like, I thought Javon Carter gave him some good minutes in the first couple games too. I'm not saying it's like, how could you go away from him? But I'm surprised at the distribution of minutes.
We will probably see, we should see maybe some more Javon Carter. I don't think he's like the be-all, end-all because he's not this dynamic offensive player.
Right. But he could hit a couple three. I'm not saying it's a slam dunk decision between him and George Hill, but it's weird that it went all the way in one direction.
Can I just say, it makes me think of, and I haven't heard too much of this yet, so pardon me if someone has said it already, but it makes me think of like Serge Ibaka, I believe, was not active for game four. Mm-hmm. And I know why they traded DiVincenzo for Serge Ibaka, because they were worried about Brook Lopez's health.
Yeah.
But like, you could really use a guy like Dante DiVincenzo.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's a tough one because you did, I mean, I think we all thought Brook was done.
Yeah, no, I mean, I thought it was more than insurance when they made the trade.
I didn't think Brook would be ready for the playoffs, let alone when he came back and he's in the regular season. Can I just throw something out there? Because I was curious about this.
Sure.
And this is not just half court, but what do you think the Bucks' offensive rating was with Giannis on the floor yesterday? If you had to guess.
If I had to guess, I would say 109.
120.5.
Wow.
I mean, he went nuclear in the third and obviously had that huge run and he was getting out in transition. I just wanted to look it up. I for some reason, I was compelled. That's pretty crazy.
That but is I, a lot higher than I thought.
Isn't it wild?
I mean, I would like to see.
The Drew plus minus thing kind of made me think of it because Drew played 40 minutes and 54 seconds and the offensive rating with him on the floor was 100.
Well, it's really interesting because that is wild. It's like Giannis.
I'm sorry,
said,
I stepped all over your question, but that stat was too crazy.
No,
I had to.
No. It's a good job by you. 34 points, 32 shots, and honestly, 6 for 11 from the free throw line. Like those 5 points,
huge man,
could have made the fourth quarter a lot different.
Yeah,
and so maybe I am speaking a little too much. I'm not giving Milwaukee enough credit. And their offense was better in game four than it was in the first three games for sure, especially in the half court. It was better. So I do want to say that. But I don't know if Boston figured something out with this small lineup. I'm really interested to see how much
man. It's
Ime Udoka
an interesting
goes to
look.
It.
Because and Grant has been so good that it's like...
Grant was bad. Yesterday.
He was not having his... I mean, the foul trouble... What's so tough about the playoffs is the margins are basically gone. Like... And... you get a couple fouls, you get out of a rhythm or whatever, and like... A player can so quickly lose a whole game like that. You know what I mean? Like, Grant was not good yesterday, but he's like... Early in the series, he was doing what Horford did yesterday. You know what I mean? It was like, oh, he was the stopper. So it's just such an interesting lineup. That's a good question. What do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's like the Milwaukee's coaching staff is going to look at all those possessions. The fact that the Celtics put Marcus Smart on Giannis in the second half and
that was interesting.
Had a decent amount of success, particularly in the fourth with Smart. Like, the Celtics don't want Jaylen Brown on Giannis at all.
And I think you could almost see Giannis when he's driving on Smart. I think he
this
knows...
This has been, like, a three-year-long thing where it's like, he is... He's talked publicly about it. He is, like, he hates going up against Smart because hates those offensive fouls.
Exactly. I was
going to
say, you can see him think. You can see him hesitate. I'm going to get an offensive foul if I drive on this guy. And that is, like... That is so valuable. That is something you would never measure about Smart. But that was what makes him so valuable, is you can see a player like Giannis hesitate going to the rim against him in a way he does not against Horford and Brown. It's funny, because watching that Giannis-Horford thing, something Jay Crowder has said multiple times, kind of like during his post-practice interviews in Phoenix and asked about in Game 4, He's like, I love the playoffs because at some point, like, scheme becomes less important and it's just mano a mano. Like, can you guard the guy in front of you? And, like, he said that a couple of times and, like, you're seeing it in this series now and it's so fun to watch.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. But when we talk about, like, oh, this guy, I think about this often when it's like, this guy is, and maybe this is a good opportunity for us to transition actually to another series, and that series is going to be Miami and Philadelphia. Just because a guy is quote unquote a weak link, or definitely clearly a weak link, you still have to score on them, and they are going to play defense. They are going to compete, and they're going to try.
Yeah.
And so I think about that with Jordan Poole and the adjustments that he made from game two to game three, and how he kind of, he knew he was going to get attacked. He did get attacked and he played better defense. And so let me just throw out my question to you, moving on to Heat Sixers. My question is, will Duncan Robinson play?
This folds into my question, because my question was basically like, will the Heat shooters step up? But I think the crux of this is we both want to talk about the three-pointer. So please, you go first, because I have thoughts on this as well.
Right. So Kyle Lowry is not playing. Kyle Lowry is one of Miami's better three-point shooters, yeah. A necessary three-point shooter.
He was their best, he was their best drop coverage beater. And that was when I knew early in that game he wasn't right, because his shot was off. And especially post-All-Star break, he was really rounding into form. And he's their drop coverage beater with that pull-up three.
Sure, exactly. So the reason Duncan Robinson is not playing and is out of the rotation, to state the obvious, is because James Harden will hunt him on every single possession. And I actually, because I'm a sad person, I went back and I watched every possession over the past two seasons where Duncan Robinson guarded James Harden. Just to I know Eric Spoelstra must have watched this film to have made such a dramatic decision to remove Duncan from the rotation. And it was 16 or 17 possessions, and almost all of them resulted in a wide open three after Harden beat Duncan off the dribble. Now Harden is coming off his best game in weeks, and he was an absolute beast in isolation in game four, whether Hero was on him, whether Jimmy was on him, PJ,
There are so many ways you could look back at the games. The Heat lost because of this. Spo was I think the Sixers shot 6 of 8 from three in the last 5 seconds of the shot clock.
Yeah, wild stat.
But when James Harden is beating Bam twice, that's a matchup the Miami Heat want. Even Doc Rivers was we got too many switches on Bam. He beat Bam for a step back three and a drive to the rim. And when that happens, that's your best. And sometimes you lose it. And that's the thing is you can look at all the stats you want. Sometimes you lose the matchup. And that's what happens in the playoffs.
Right. So I wonder, coming off that game, is now the best time to put Robinson into that blender? Probably not. But I think that Eric Spoelstra might be overthinking this right now. The Heat are shooting 30% on wide open threes in the postseason. They're at 28.5% in this series. Duncan Robinson is one of the greatest three-point shooters in league
ever.
History.
Yeah, ever. Truly, yeah.
Just see how it goes. And honestly, that strategy in the first two games was on removing Duncan from the rotation was predicated largely on the fact that they knew Harden was the reason that, Harden was their offense.
They were going to go five out, right.
Now, Joel Embiid is playing. So I wonder, with Embiid on the floor now, you could argue that Harden isolations aren't even the best offensive option that Philadelphia can go to, and it takes them away from Harden and Embiid pick and rolls. Yeah. So I'm a little surprised that the adjustment hasn't already been made, frankly.
Yeah.
And I would be shocked if in game five, Duncan Robinson didn't play a significant role.
I think Spo's listen, the guy's a legend, all right? He's top 15, Hall of Fame, whatever. So here I am.
He's coaching against a fellow top 15 coach.
So here I am about to say something so stupid, but there's a couple decisions Spo's made in this series that I question. Duncan is one of them. I think that in both games 3 and 4 in Philly, I think he made a mistake with Jimmy's rotation. And I understand you're balancing what position the series is in, this guy's individual rotation, how hot he's been, getting him his usual rest, etc. And he was quicker to put him back in the fourth in game four. But when you have a chance to go up 3-0 or 3-1 and kind of effectively, you're not ending a series, but it makes such a big difference that to me, I think he's got to be more aggressive in that scenario. I mean, look what the Bucks did up 3-1, the amount they pushed Giannis in the way they don't normally do. I think you have to be more aggressive as a coach in that situation, and I was surprised he wasn't. And then you talk about the Duncan thing. Now, this is interesting because I think a big thing in this series is the three-point shooting, right? I think Philly was 14-64 in games 1 and 2. Miami was 14-65 in games 3 and 4. It switched completely, and I think the really easy thing to do is to be like, hey, look at Embiid. And I tweeted this, the Sixers are plus whatever from three. I'm not sure how much of it is Embiid, though. How much is it this team missing shots? One Sixers fan was like, this is an advanced stat. And I was like, what are you talking about? This guy was like, you could talk about advanced stats all you want. And I was like, I said one team made more threes than the other, dude. You should just admit you didn't watch the game. And I was like, oh, man. People are getting mad. But Shout out to Wes Goldberg, who tweeted out this stat. I mean, it's on NBA.com, but the Heat took, I think, 34 open or wide open threes, according to the NBA's tracking data. They're getting a lot different threes, though. Like, the Sixers with Embiid in the game, they're guarding the pick and roll two-on-two. They're kind of daring Jimmy to score as much as he is. I don't think that what he's doing is sustainable, as great as he's been. But the corner three is gone for Miami. Like, they're not pulling in those defenders away from Philly's, or Philly's not moving their defenders off Miami's shooters. Like, no matter what, you know, Jimmy's doing in the half court. I actually think it's what Phoenix should do, but they're planted on those shooters and saying, yeah, okay, go ahead, Jimmy. If you can beat Embiid at the rim, we'll live with that. But what they are getting are the handoffs. Embiid's dropping when Bam is doing a handoff, whether it's with Strus, Lowry, etc. That is their bread and butter. That is Bam and Duncan's bread and butter. That mm-hmm. play made Duncan Robinson $90 million. Like, I think if at least see if you can get Philly out of their base coverage by running enough Duncan handoffs that Embiid can't drop anymore. And now you're maybe getting them to blink. So I'm with you. It's crazy to me that he hasn't played, because that's what they do best.
So if Duncan does play, like, whose minutes is he eating beyond Kyle Lowry? Just like, how would you, I guess that's not even the right way to frame the question.
No, because I think he has to eat into Strus's minutes, because I'm not going to sit here and say Duncan's going to put up a strong fight against Harden. I think that they've shown at times, even in the 2020 finals, during this regular season, they've shown at times they can defend with him on the floor. I just don't think you can play him and Hero together. You have to find a way to break them up.
Mm-hmm. So
that's almost an argument for Duncan to start, frankly.
I guess, like, what I'm trying to ask is, like, I did not like Victor Oladipo's minutes in game four.
I don't disagree.
And if you go back and watch, a lot of Philly's threes that were open were the result of an Oladipo mistake. And his shots on the other end were not... I know he got to the line, 10 times, made 8 free throws.
I mean, that was needed. I don't want to minimize that. That was really needed, especially with Lowry out. But yes, he plays, I think, good on-ball defense with Harden, like, if he's picking him up. But go ahead. You were making the point.
I just don't... 32 minutes from him. If you told me coming into this series that this guy played 32 minutes in game four, I would assume that something went wrong. And I guess, like, Kyle Lowry's bum hamstring, I guess, is qualifying as something wrong. But I just... Like, I would give those minutes to Duncan Robinson.
Or Gabe Vincent played only 9 minutes. And, I mean, he filled in for Lowry many times and did a really good job and was a good three-point shooter as well. He had some foul trouble, but I think Vincent needs to play more as well.
It's interesting. It's really, like, it's clear that Spo has prioritized defense in this series. And I wonder how dramatically he's going to kind of tilt away from that mindset and that ideology and go back towards, like, we got to make shots. We got to make life easier for Bam, for Jimmy. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm looking out for. I still think that Miami should win the series, frankly. Like, I'm not too hopped up on Embiid's back.
Right. I do think that game four... I think Miami's going to look back at that one and be like, if we'd brought in Jimmy earlier, Harden went 6-10 from three and hit a couple tough step backs. I mean, you're really looking at that game. I think if Spo, I think, is looking at that as a shot variance game, but that doesn't change the fact that you lost it. It's a toss up to me. I really don't know which way I'm leaning. I really don't.
Matisse Thybul hit like a corner three, like on a short. I mean, they obviously closed short on him, but like, that kind of scares me. I know that Spo pointed out that stat after the game about the late shot clock threes, and he's right. And you shouldn't. I mean,
their overall shooting in late shot clock was kind of out of this world.
Yeah. I'm still thinking Miami should feel confident, with especially with two games at home. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to keep my eye on Duncan Robinson's minutes. I know it feels like I'm like over hyping.
No, but I know what you mean. It's I'm like, their best way to get open threes against Joel Embiid is not by collapsing the defense on pick and rolls. It's on dribble handoffs. And that is Duncan and Bam's best play. It's an elite action. It is an action that has won a lot of games for the Miami Heat over the last few regular seasons. It's kind of crazy that they haven't gone to it when that's your best way to get open looks against Embiid.
What series do you want to...
Oh, can I throw one more thing out real quick? Sure. It's literally Tyrese Maxey, so much better than Tyler Hero. Okay, we can continue.
Okay, you're breaking my brain. I love Maxey.
I love Maxey. And low-key, the Heat have not had an answer for him. When he gets PJ Tucker on a switch, it does not look good. Maxey's blown by him every time. He scored a tough end-of-half bucket on Jimmy Butler. Like, you could tell Jimmy was like, okay, like, all right, let me guard this guy, you know? And, like, Jimmy had some crazy defensive possessions in that game, on Harden drives especially, but... Maxey's been good, man. I really like Maxey.
Maxey's awesome. Okay, what series do you want to go to next?
Let's go to Phoenix, Dallas, because I was there.
Oh, your expertise.
And that game four, we were talking about this yesterday when we tried to record the podcast, but could not. That game four was a hostile environment, was intense. You could sense the animosity between the teams in the opening minutes. And I feel like there's been all this focus on Phoenix's defense. Like, look at the threes the Mavs are getting. The Mavs have been shooting almost 43s a game since game one. And I'm more worried about the Suns' offense, which posted, like, back-to-back games, at least a 130 offensive rating. And they averaged, I think, under 100 points in games three and four. So, yeah, I just want to go to that one because my question is, like, what is going on with Phoenix's offense?
Okay, my question was, in his post-game column, how will Rohan find a way to carry Chris Paul's water?
I think I was pretty critical of Chris Paul in my most recent...
You were, but I actually screenshot on my phone because I'm going to throw it at you when we have to get into the text wars at some point. But I screenshot a graph that you did write about the fouls that Chris Paul committed and how three of them were not fouls.
I didn't say they were not
and
fouls.
I said they were fouls.
I said they were controversial.
I will say the sixth one. Probably you don't want to call that in a playoff game.
the sixth one, I just straight up think that was a terrible call. The offensive foul that he had where he stuck his butt out, I thought that should have been a no call. I don't think that should have been an offensive foul. I mean, that's not been called an offensive foul the entire season.
Well, disagree. That's not something that you're allowed to do anymore because Chris Paul was doing it so often and trying to manipulate the game.
But we've seen that not get called this entire year.
Okay. Well, guys don't do it because it's an offensive foul. They stop
and
doing
it. And I also think that, and I said on the Luka one, like, there was contact, but it was also exaggerated.
So that was also a foul, though, and that was a really silly one for him to. That was the one I texted. I don't know. I texted something to you guys. I was like, "That was just."
I mean, it was a dumb play. It was a bad decision. It was a reckless decision. I agreed.
Okay, so let's get back to Phoenix's offense. Tell me what you like think is the issue here. And
well,
I mean,
it's been Paul. I mean, it's seven turnovers in the first half of Game Three. He's only able to play 23 minutes in Game Four. They didn't have great offense when he was on the floor, but it was a lot better. I mean, I think they had a 113 offensive rating when he was on the floor. Obviously not as good as games one and two, but they finished around 107, which means they were really bad with him off the floor. And I asked Monty about it after the game. I asked Jay Crowder after about the game. Oh, Mike. So I'm trying to ask Devin Booker a question after the game, okay? We're in this tiny press conference room in Phoenix. And so I'm like, Devin, like, did you, you know, because he was like, I actually like the shots we got. And I mentioned, I was like, you know, the offense has dipped. Do you feel like, you know, that's, you know, you guys aren't executing right? Is it something that they've done that's kind of taken you out offensively? And he looks at me, he's like, who's they? And I was like, oh, shit. I was like, Dallas? But he thought I was talking about the refs because there had been so much conversation about the refs in this series that he thought I was trying to bait him into criticizing the refs again because there was a lot of conversation about that. But I think an issue, DeAndre Ayton's not been good since game one. And I don't think that they are doing a good job of trying to, like, take advantage of Dallas' small lineups. I understand that just because you throw the ball into Ayton or get a seal on Kleber, like, Dallas isn't going to all of a sudden start switch its coverages. But, like, this is what we talked about with Ayton. This is what I wrote about, and I thought he did a fantastic job of it in game one. But since then, I don't think they just need more from him in those looks. Even if it makes a Dallas defender take an extra step away from someone else, I think they need more from him there. And, yeah, Paul has to be better. I mean, I said that. Like, the turnovers have been an issue. The fouls, like, that's on him. He said it. He can't put himself in that position. He did. And those were reckless decisions. So those are the kind of the two things I had my eye on, at least early. Because I think Dallas is now doing a more of a hedge and recover with Luka. And are able to get away with it. As you mentioned, just because you get the switch you want doesn't mean it's an automatic score.
Yeah, Mikal Bridges has only taken 9 threes in the series. He's only made 2 threes in the series. Kind of weird. That's not like a humongous barometer for their success, but he should probably be averaging more than 10 points per game and probably should not have fewer than half the three-point attempts that Cam Johnson has in the series. I agree with you on Ayton, who, yeah, he's got to be more physical.
I mean, he missed like a couple like easy looks at the rim in game four. Like, just, yeah, he's got to step it up.
I think that it's really easy to look at CP and his struggles and kind of just decide that if CP plays better, their offense will play better. I noticed that Booker said, you know, when you do hit the threes that Dallas hit as many as they did, I think they hit 20 in game four, I want to say, and they're shooting like 40% for the series. When they hit threes, obviously they can go back.
Yeah, their defense set up is in set. The half court. Yeah, yeah, he mentioned that,
and that's not something to scoff at. That is
definitely no. That's big. That's big.
And one of the reasons their offense is really good. Like, they're very good in the half court. Obviously, they can play slow. They can out execute you, etc. In the playoffs, it's just a little bit harder to do that when you're not getting stops. And I think that the relationship between their great defense and their really good offense all year is key to their success. So they get stops, they run. They played a little bit faster this year than they did last year. So I think that matters. And, you know, if Dallas stops making threes at the rate that they did in those two games, then we could see a bounce back. I also kind of am just like, Chris Paul will not do what he did again. And that will solve a lot of the issues. I don't think there's a systemic problem here.
I really wanted to ask him about it. It wasn't the moment. I mean, we talked about this briefly. I didn't mention on the pod. He had that incident with the Mavs fans and his family during the game. During the press conference, he kept looking at his phone. Like, you could tell something was wrong. Like, it was strange, and he kept trying to ask to leave. Like, I've seen Chris Paul, like, after finals losses, answer questions like, it was strange. I really wanted to ask him, like, when he has 7 turnovers in a game, does he even bother going back to look at them, or does he just go like, yeah, I know that's not going to happen again? Like, him having that many turnovers was shocking. And credit to Dallas's defense, which was really good during the regular season and can give teams problems with their length. And I think Bullock's done a great job picking him up full court. Mm-hmm. They've made life hard on him for sure.
They have. A lot of sloppy turnovers from him, though, where he's getting sped up in ways that he just doesn't normally get sped up. Did you want to talk about the thing that happened with his family for 2 seconds, or do you think that it's not even we're past that moment?
We're past it. I mean, it's just a weird situation, and I feel like people are like, "What really happened here?" And I'm like, I just look at it as like, how many hundreds or how many thousands of basketball games has Chris Paul been a part of professionally? Am I really going to believe that like he got upset over something that didn't happen? Like, to me, it does. I don't need like much to go off of here. Like I think it's pretty simple. Like, don't, you know, mess with someone's family.
Don't touch people who don't want to be touched. The end. Yeah. Okay. So my question for this series, my actual question was, how do the Suns deal with Luka Doncic post-ups? And why doesn't Dallas just
You don't think they should stick to the campaign matchup?
Well, I'm just like, why doesn't Dallas post up Luka over and over and over again? They did it more and more as the series has progressed. And he's not necessarily scoring out of it, but a lot of the three-point looks that they're getting and they're knocking them down are off of his post-up actions when he does draw help, when he gets CP on him or he gets campaign on him or even Bridges. Bridges
Bridges has been – the physicality of the series, I think, is getting to Bridges. Watching Luka post-up campaign was honestly getting uncomfortable. Like, I was like, I can't watch much more of this. Like, this is –
It's either you don't play him, but the thing about the post up with Luka, like you can get, I mean, you can, there's a lot of different ways you can get someone in the post if you really want to. And I get how, like, you don't want to take him out of pick and rolls. He's had a lot of success in pick and roll actions, of course, because he's Luka. Very difficult to guard out of those situations. He'll isolate on bigs. Ayton had actually a pretty good block on one.
Ayton had a good, great possession on Luka where he kind of really chased him around the floor.
It was one play though, and Luka also was like, "Oh, you're dropping. I'm gonna hit a floater. Oh, you're blitzing," even though he didn't.
They've been blowing up the Bridges Ayton pick and roll defensive combo. Those are their two guys, and it hasn't done much. I mean, the Suns started switching like 5 minutes into game four, and they're not a switch team, but they were like, yeah, we got to start switching.
So like when Jason Kidd hopefully starts Maxi Kleber in game five, which I'm just like, why isn't Maxi Kleber starting? What is going on? When he does start him, I just like, you have 5 3-point shooters on the floor. Or you're going to have four. I mean, Bertans like in the rotation, just knocking down ridiculous shots now too. And it's like, what do you do when Luka is backing you down? Is like on his third dribble, and the help isn't coming. And all of a sudden, he's 8 feet from the hoop. Like, what do you do? And why isn't Dallas doing this on every play? This is my question.
He's just gonna turn you into the Joker. You want to know? You don't understand why. Honestly, I'm coming around to the idea that Phoenix should maybe like let Luka try to score 50.
Really?
Because So correlation is not causation, but Luka had the huge scoring games in games 1 and 2, which were the games the Suns won. And my reasoning is twofold. One, I mean, two is better than three if you're a defense. Their shooters have shown that they can go off. You know, they cheated off Bertans, and like they cheated off Finney Smith. They cheated off everyone, and those guys lit them up. But those guys are also useless offensively if they're standing in the corner and you have someone just stuck to them and say, "We're not cheating off." And I think Philly like had a little bit of success with that against Miami. Doing something similar, be like, okay, Jimmy Butler, go get 40 points. I mean, obviously, Luka's a much more talented offensive player than Jimmy. Like, he's probably going to go off for even more. But I think a couple things. Like, two is better than three. And beyond that, I think Luka gets more tired playing that way. I think
that's okay. So
that's the post-up thing too, right? Because it's like,
yeah,
those are favorable matchups for him, but it's still physical. He's still banging his body. And yeah, I think he gets worn down faster scoring every time than passing every time.
No, that's the point I was going to make about why they actually don't do that, because these are human beings who get tired and banging.
Yeah, they can't turn fatigue
over and
off.
Over again yeah. is tough. So that's why I get that, but I would like to see more than 10 post-ups for Luka, given how fruitful they have been in the series. And like the thing that it also does and has the potential to do, and this is why Embiid is Embiid and why his post-ups are absurd, is they get you in the bonus quick. Mm-hmm. And so when Bridges has like no defensive options except like he's got a foul, like, and maybe he's a great defensive player, maybe he adjusts, maybe he figures something out, maybe they switch the matchup up and put Crowder on him, but then if you do that, then you're just going to put him in pick it. So like I don't know, I feel like just the post up could unlock a lot of things for Dallas. I understand how it makes their offense stagnant, but at the end of the day, because of how they're built, I do think that Luka having big games is good for them, and that you can't necessarily rely on Dorian Finney-Smith to go 8-for-12 behind the three-point line again in this series. So those are my thoughts on that, but this is a fun series.
It is. It's been good, man. I mean, dude, we were so close to having 4-2-2s. Like, we'll obviously get to the last series. The basketball gods were so close to blessing us, but we have three really good 2-2 series, and I think any team can win any of the three. Like, I think they're still all really, really close series. So I'm really excited. But yeah, man, I don't know. I'm really coming around to the idea, like, can you wear Luka out? Can you? What happens if Dallas shoots only 33s as opposed to 43s? But we'll see. It's easier for me to just throw it out from the couch when I'm not getting abused by Luka in the post. But I mean, I think he'd get tired.
Let's move on to that last series, the only 3-1 series in the second round, the Memphis Grizzlies versus the Golden State Warriors. I'm actually going to give the question assignment for now to a emailer, Eric, who writes in, "Hi, Mike, Rohan, and Chris. Greetings from the city by the bay. As both the regular season and playoffs have progressed, it is becoming more and more clear that Jordan Poole is a better offensive player than Klay Thompson. So at what point do the Warriors acknowledge this and invert the shot distribution so that Poole gets 18 to 20 shots and Klay gets 14 to 16 shots? Is this even possible? Agree or disagree that in order for the Warriors to advance, Poole needs to become the second option and Klay becomes the third option?" Eric, thank you so much for this question. There's a lot to dissect in this series that we'll get to. I don't know if this is the most important question, but I appreciate it.
Do you think Poole's been better than Klay in the playoffs so far?
I honestly don't. I mean, it's tough. It's tough because there's two reasons why I would point to Klay, who his shot selection sometimes really wanes, and it waned in game 4 last night where he's just taken some really tough off-balance contested looks inside the three-point line, and they're not going in. But at the same time, when I watch Klay, and I truly think that Steve Kerr or Mike Brown or whoever has been around him that long, as long as those guys have, like, when the ball leaves his hands, you just think it's going in. Like, I still think that every time.
Oh, he's terrifying. He's terrifying.
So there's two things that why I would say I like Klay more still. His gravity and his defense. He's not the same defender that he was, but that's fine.
He's better than what Poole is right now still.
Poole is straight up, like, he compromises the defense. And
he's barbecue chicken alert. Did you see the Inside the NBA brief discussion about Shaq versus Rudy Gobert?
I did not.
Rudy said on Instagram that he would lock Shaq's ass up, and Shaq obviously had to respond on the show, and Chuck was kind of instigating him. And Chuck was like, Rudy, Rudy. And Shaq was just sitting there like smug, like, I know I got this. And finally he's just like, I wonder what French barbecue chicken tastes like. Just legendary. Absolutely legendary.
You love to see it. Yeah. So last night, just talking about the game real quick. I thought that so we were texting last night after the Celtics game. You guys, I felt like you were trolling me by saying that the Bucks blew that game.
I truly was not. I genuinely feel that way.
And I was going to text you. I forget if even I did. I'm delirious at like 2 in the morning when these games end. But like the Grizzlies blew that game.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So the Grizzlies should have won that game.
The Grizzlies, I thought the Warriors clearly didn't care about that game. Like, they can say whatever they want. They did not have a championship-level focus for that game. Let's just say that. But I thought they'd go on their big third-quarter run, and that would be that. And then it's like, okay, Memphis is still winning. Then I'm like, all right, they'll bring in Steph and Dre early in the fourth and, you know, kind of blow this thing open. And it's like, no, Memphis is still winning. And then Dylan Brooks dribbles the ball off his foot, and I'm like, okay, the turn is coming here. And I'm like, you know, it's actually still pretty close here, but Memphis is staying ahead. They should have won that game. They should have won that game.
You look at, like, Jaren Jackson Jr.'s box score, and you're like, oh, he had kind of a crappy game. I mean, 0-7 from behind the three-point line.
He was sick in the fourth.
I thought, like, I was like, oh, this dude is, like, a matchup nightmare right now.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I watched in person, like, every minute of the first round when he was one of the worst players in the entire series, straight up. But, like, I was like, this is the Jaren Jackson Jr. who...
This is the guy who, like, I picked for most improved. Yeah, man.
This is, like, the guy who can get you a bucket, like, driving a closeout, who...
Well, he almost hit that game winner.
Has post moves. Yeah, and I, honestly, like, I'm not gonna lie, I thought he was fouled on that three. Like,
he was.
I know they said he was, it was like a block. I forget who was calling the game. Was it Ian Eagle? I think.
Yeah,
maybe.
I think so. Yeah.
I forget. Said that Draymond Green didn't get the block, and I was like watching. I was like, did he block that? And then on the replay, it doesn't look like he got any of the ball. And Taylor Jenkins commented, but like,
but the Taylor Jenkins has got to know when to stop too. It's getting embarrassing from them. It's getting really embarrassing. It's getting like, stop. You guys have lost all the goodwill. That was another game from Jaren Jackson. You mentioned that you look at the box score. Sometimes you look at a box score of an NBA game and it obviously does not tell the story. I'm not breaking news by saying that, but there are certain nights in the playoffs where it's a whatever it takes game. And I thought Jaren Jackson Jr. was playing a whatever it takes game. Like, efficiency stops mattering. Like, you're just finding a way to win a slugfest. And he really almost brought them over the finish line and probably would have if Dylan Brooks didn't go full Dylan.
Dylan Brooks had a very interesting night, we shall say.
Offensively, we should say.
Offensively, I mean, I saw some, like, Dylan Brooks. It's like, if you've watched the Memphis Grizzlies all season, I know he's only played, like, 39 games because of the high ankle sprain. But if you watch them all season or you watch them, I don't know, like even last season or if you watch the first round.
Well, remember, he had the big game in the play-in that knocked them out, I believe. Like, didn't he have like 24 points or something? He had the big game one against Utah. Like, anyway, go ahead. You'll make your point.
It's like, the point is like, it doesn't... I saw someone tweet, like, I don't know how Dylan Brooks is going to come back from this. And I'm just like, do you know who Dylan Brooks is? Like, he forgets... He could miss 35 shots in a row. He doesn't care who's guarding him.
He's
what, like, the shot quality is. Don't even say those words to that man.
The ultimate does not give a fuck player. Just the ultimate does not give a fuck player in the league right now.
So he finished 5-for-19, 12 points, 8 assists, which honestly, someone texted me after the game letting me know that, and I was like, I can't think of one of those 8 assists, but shout out to him. His defense on Steph was pretty good, not perfect, but no
he's
one
also
guards
like,
Steph perfect.
He's also, they showed it on the broadcast, but they had that play where Clay got a corner three off an inbounds, and before the pass, Dylan is pointing at the corner like, this is the play, this is the play. He's that guy for them. He's not Draymond Green, but he is their Draymond. He's the guy that knows the other players' tendencies, actions, etc. Like, you can't overstate how important he is to their defense.
So one of the other things, I know we're not really hitting any
questions.
Did you have an official question for this series? Because I, like, actually don't really. I just thought it was a really fun, fascinating game. And I guess my question is, like, is the series over? And
honestly,
that was
going to be mine as well, to be perfectly honest. Because I just thought they blew it. I just thought they blew it, man.
I'll say I agree that they blew that game and should have absolutely won. I also think, like, epic flop by Steph Curry on Desmond Bane with, like, a minute.
Dude, they didn't mention that on the broadcast at all, and I was like, what? And I would, like, Bane, I mean, Bane.
We're talking about flops a lot, and people have lost sight of what a flop truly is. Like, if someone hits you with their forearm and extends their arm and you fall over, like, sometimes maybe that's a flop. You're also just, like, trying to, like, Desmond Bane maybe had, like, his fingernails on the jersey, Steph's jersey,
for
that rebound.
No.
And Steph hit the deck.
This is a great point, because a flop, like, yes, sometimes a player gets actually fouled and they go down when they're not supposed to, but they do that to ensure the proper foul is called. Like, what Steph did was take a play that should not have been a foul, but flopped so hard that it became a foul. But, and, like, Bane didn't even argue it. And I was like, I don't know if his back is in so much pain that he's like, it's not worth it. But I was so, like, blown
this
away by
is,
how nonchalant he was about that insane flop.
Bane really, I mean, it's interesting to me. Like, he must be so exhausted because, I mean, what, he played 37 minutes. He's guarding the Golden State Warriors in the half court when Steph's on the floor, when Klay's on the floor, when Jordan Poole's on the floor, switching, denying.
The amount of emotional labor it takes to guard the Warriors is more than any other team in the NBA.
And this guy sprints. He closes out with discipline. He just played a really solid defensive game, as always.
Man, he's so good.
I love Desmond Bane, and it's just a shame that his back clearly isn't right.
You can tell he's not right.
But, oh yeah, what I wanted to say about this game, and one of the reasons why I actually think that the series is not over, besides the fact that, you know, we have to assume
it's going back
to Memphis, sure, sure, and I think that they can definitely win game five if Ja plays, and Ja looks like Ja. But, like, I tweeted this right before tip-off, starting Steven Adams was kind of like,
I loved it.
Smart. Like, this guy was a part of your identity. He was a reason for your success the entire season. He finished this game plus 13. Everyone said that. This is what I was talking about earlier about, like, switching and being hunted. It's like, just let these pros play sometimes. And, like, sometimes as a coach, you get inside your own head. You think that that Tillman is going to defend better because
Tillman was getting cooked.
So it's like, Adams finishes plus 13. I know a lot of stuff goes into that. He's critical on the screens. He's critical off ball screens. He's critical on ball screens.
Defensive communication.
He's critical on the offensive glass, creating second chance opportunities.
What do you have, like, six offensive rebounds? Like, he was killing the glass.
Yes, he had six offensive rebounds, 15 rebounds total, three assists. And it's like, what he does for Jaren Jackson Jr. as well cannot be overstated, in terms of Jaren staying out of foul trouble, in terms of Jaren getting to guard fours a little bit more. I know that Otto Porter went off and hit some threes, and that's partially because Jaren's out there. He's also trying to patrol the paint. But, like, I just liked starting Steven Adams, and I want to see this team with Ja, with Adams, like, be itself. I just, with everyone kind of in roles that they were in during the regular season, I'm not saying that they can definitely win three in a row. That would be surprising. But if you win two in a row, which I think they could do, and then you go to a game seven and anything happens, Jordan Poole sprains his ankle, like, I'm not ruling out a Grizzlies comeback.
I hope they get it to seven. I think they'll get it to six. But that was a... I don't know how the teams do it. I've been asking players about it in Phoenix. And, you know, Giannis talked about it after the game. You know, emotions are for movies, not for basketball. But I honestly think it's such an under-discussed aspect of the playoffs, and it's impossible to quantify. But not, you know, and Spo said it. I have to look back at the film and see what's real and what's emotional. But the mental focus it takes to bounce back from something like that, to manage your emotions, is not easy. It's really not easy. And every team has to go through it during the playoffs, but I really don't know how they do it.
Can we read one more email? Do you have time in your busy schedule?
I'll pod for 2 hours, man. I love talking about the playoffs. I love talking about poops. I look forward to this every week. Let's ride.
Okay. I hope this is the email.
You're taking this earlier. You're just doing this because you want to guess which one was the one I don't like. That's why you're doing this.
It's one that I wanted to actually. I'm just going to read the email.
Okay,
and we can get into it. Okay, so it comes from Darren, who writes, "Hello, Michael, Rohan, and Chris. As a basketball fan without a team in the Final Eight, I can't help but notice how almost everyone involved, be it fans, players, coaches, or those covering the game, seems overly focused on officiating. Mm-hmm. Instead of the 8 best teams playing 4 competitive series that were all 2-1 through 3 games, Darren obviously submitted this email a little while ago, it is about who is getting calls and who isn't. A classic old-school physical Celtics and Bucks game 3 is only about Giannis not getting called for charges or the Celtics' physical defense.
I agree.
Defense
Ime Udoka ruined that series with his public comments.
In a single Bucks free throw the last 16-plus minutes, or the coach of a team with Marcus Smart saying he should teach them to flop more.
I love this email.
It isn't just the narrative. Every drive that doesn't result in a basket or foul seems to result in a player waving his hands for a foul, like a wide receiver begging for pass interference. Under Adam Silver, the NBA has always seemed to go with, if the league is trending on Twitter, the league is winning no matter what the subject is. But this can't be what the league wants its playoff discussion to be about. What, if anything, can be done?
Is this the email? No, I like this email. This email. It's a good question. It's been a storyline.
I like this email, too. I was actually very hopped up to read it yesterday on yesterday's show because pre-game 4 of Celtics-Bucks because I thought that some of the dialogue in... So I'll answer this just by saying, and I said this on last week's episode with Chris, like, I don't get caught up in officiating. I find that it's a much easier product to enjoy, the NBA basketball. Once you realize,
once you stop learning the officials' names, just it's not worth it.
Yes, once you and I wonder how much gambling has to do with this, but assigning records to players based on who is the official is one of the most sad ways to watch.
Could not agree more.
So just accept that all these things cross bad call. Everyone gets bad calls. Everyone benefits from bad calls, and it all evens out. The universe is straight even by the end of the day. That's how I view everything. Mm-hmm. And the way that this email ends with "What if anything can be done?" It's like Milwaukee Bucks general manager John Horst. Speaking to The Athletic, he did an interview with The Athletic earlier this week after game 3.
Yeah.
It was after game 3. Bucks win. And he does an interview complaining about the officiating, which I don't know if there is precedent for that. You can check me on that, or our listeners can check me on that.
I couldn't believe the tweet when I saw it.
I thought I was living in the Twilight Zone. I was like, did the Celtics win? What is going... And I read the article.
Listen, I'm not advocating for it. I understand why the Bucks felt like they needed to respond to Udoka, to be perfectly honest. That's not a troll. I felt like they wanted to respond to that. I really do.
The GM of the team...
I'm not saying it's a good look.
Champion.
I'm not saying it's a good look.
It's not... I'm not even saying good or bad. It was frankly a little bizarre.
It was shocking
to see. I don't know when that's ever happened. And honestly, teams argue about like calls. They submit film to the league after games. That's like a private thing.
Yeah.
So for this interview to be public after game three of the second round as the defending champions and a game you won when you're up 2-1 in the series.
And the most controversial call of the game went in your favor. Like, yes, AS, I'm sure both teams submitted a lot of film. But the thing everyone remembered was from the very end of the game, a very controversial call that your team was on the good side of.
Right. So in the article, I just want to say... So Horst cites Drew Holiday not taking any free throws despite attempting 30 shots. And Horst or someone from the Bucks organization supplied tracking data to claim that the Celtics attempted 11 free throws on 14 drives in the fourth quarter, while the Bucks had 10 drives that resulted in zero free throws. And I went back and I watched all of the drives. And basketball doesn't work where... Just because you drive the ball means that you, if you drive the ball 10 times, you get to go to the free throw line 3 times.
Yep.
Like, so for a defense, it was just a very ironic statement from a defense that has it teaches how not to foul. And under Mike Budenholzer has always been first or near the league lead in opposing free throw rate because of how they defend. And I believe they're number one in the postseason right now and opposing free throw rate, because that's how they are. So for you to just be like, Drew took 30 shots and he didn't get to the free throw line, and what's up with that? And it's like, if you watch all Drew's shots, just tell me which one you would like him to be fouled on. There are no fouls. So I thought that that was weird. Though I just want to say one last thing about this. Also in that article, I'm just going to read the quote. From John Horst, the Grant Williams play on Grayson, it's just uncalled for. Anyone who watched that play knows it was dangerous. Grayson was sore last night. He was sore again this morning. I think he'll play in game four, but it was a dangerous play. It was a non-basketball play, and it's uncalled for. So, to set the scene, it is the second quarter. The play begins with Grayson Allen and Jason Tatum.
This is so funny. Oh,
and Jason Tatum going after a loose ball in the backcourt. Grayson Allen pushes Jason Tatum in the back. Jason Tatum falls to the ground. Then Drew Holiday hits a three on the other end in the chaos. When Drew Holiday's three falls through the net, Grant Williams goes over and in a box out, kind of hip checks Grayson Allen. Like, I'll say it was a physical play. Absolutely. For sure.
I think he should be suspended the rest of the series.
Sure. Kicked out of the league.
Yeah.
To cite this play, 2 seconds after the player that you're saying was a victim pushed another player to the ground going for a loose ball and there was no foul called. And if you watch the broadcast, that's what Brian Anderson says. He's like, no foul called. The deck.
Yeah.
So it's just like I don't know. I just think all of it's really
listen, the
it
league,
was just really interesting.
We were going to talk about this before my technical difficulties yesterday, but the vibes over the weekend were teetering a bit. Like, it was not fun hearing about all this. He's a dirty player. He broke the code. The officiating. The league needs to get a lid on this, man. There's great basketball going on. That should be the focus. And I don't think the conversation has been overtaken or anything like that. But no one wants to talk about this. And I do feel every fan in their life has experienced at some point, like, oh, every call is not going on our way. And that sucks. Like, you don't want people feeling that way during a playoff game. But it just feels like the league needs to find a way to get a handle on this. Whether it's like, hey, if you're calling someone dirt, we want opponents and players. We want people to be candid. At the same time, like, the public posturing is just getting absurd. Like, whether it's Taylor Jenkins. And frankly, I understand where the Grizzlies are coming from, because the Warriors kind of kicked this off with Dylan broke the code. Like, we thought that was a reckless play. We thought he should be suspended. But we didn't come out and say on our podcast, like, look, you know, Dylan Brooks attempted to harm. And, you know, it just is enough already. Enough. I'm sick of it, to be honest.
I mean, this isn't new.
It's not, but it feels like it's just gotten so ridiculous.
I agree that it's
like
ridiculous.
I remember Frank Vogel coming into a series against the Pacers and Heat once and being like, yeah, they're a bunch of floppers. That's cool. I like that. Like, okay, that's him trying to set an agenda. That's him trying to, you know, work the refs a little bit. Like, there's elements of working the refs, but like now doing it where it's like, you know, there's a prudering every frame of a, you know, it just, you know, the Rockets did that thing with the memo to the league a few years ago, but at least that was in private. Like, it's just getting embarrassing.
Well, man. It wasn't fully private. Also,
yeah.
Leaked.
Yeah, true.
By I wonder who.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just
it was leaked by Cheryl Morey.
Sure. Yeah. I just
Cheryl Morey @gmail.com. Yeah. Hey.
I think that it's just a bummer to me that sometimes the officiating, and these guys are playing physical for sure. It's just a bummer when the officiating is the number one thing that is on everyone's mind and everyone wants to talk about it. And I'll just real quickly say, like, I was at a wedding on Saturday, and there were some Celtics fans there. There were some Bucks fans there. The game was going on, and I was, apologies. I hope that the bride and groom never listened to this episode, but I was watching the game on my phone during the ceremony, and there were people over my shoulder. And once the ceremony
the
ended,
ceremony.
Once the ceremony ended,
come on, dude, reception, the ceremony.
So after it was over, you
what,
know, how,
what row were you in?
I don't know. I'm not like being rude about it. Like I'm extremely discreet. Extremely discreet. Anywho, we're not going to get bogged down in the details. But people were coming up to me afterwards and like, oh, like the officiating was the number one thing everyone wanted to talk about. And I'm like, I'm sorry. The Celtics missed these two threes at the end. We should talk about that. Like, yeah. That's what happened here. So it's frustrating when you're in the wild and you're talking to people and they're like, all they want to talk about is referees and calls and whistles. And I'm like, that's not how basketball should be enjoyed. So that was just my point there. And the basketball is fun otherwise. And these playoffs are actually really awesome. So, Rohan, is that going to do it for today's show?
I think so. Yeah, wow. We made up for the absence. Again, apologies for the one-day delay here, but two really exciting Game 5s tonight, so I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, Rohan, for your expertise and your insight. Thank you so much to our Open Floor Globe listeners. Emailers Ellie and David, also, we were meant to get to...
And
I think
one of yours I hated, but I can't remember.
Okay, well,
so
we'll never know. We're going to read those in a future episode, so stay tuned. Thank you so much for writing in. Everyone else, please keep the questions coming. Openfloormail@gmail.com. That's openfloormail@gmail.com. Everybody stay safe. Everybody continue to enjoy the NBA playoffs.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.